I'm Mike Pollea. I'm one of the developers here on the Patterns and Practices team. And this is Hammett. He's a program manager over on the MEF team. And we're going to be talking with you guys this morning about IOC containers. And before we get really into the talk, who here understands what inversion of control is? Who here has heard about dependency injection? Who here uses either in their development practices? Okay, so we've got a fair number of folks who are at least familiar with the ideas here, and a fair number who aren't. So Don had asked for Hammett and I to do this talk early in the conference to make sure that everybody was on the same level playing field with their understanding of dependency injection and inversion of control, because these are things that are used in a lot of the patterns and practices deliverables. Enterprise Library, Prism make heavy use of DI or IOC, and it's also a topic that is a bit controversial. And Hammett and I are actually up here with differing viewpoints on a number of things around DI and IOC, and we'll probably bring a few of those up in the discussion here. But we're going to start off with Hammett talking about the principles and the ideas behind IOC and what it is, and then we'll move over to Visual Studio and do a bit of coding with both Unity and MEF, showing some examples of IOC and DI in a simplified but close to real world scenario.
Yep.
We'll let you take over.
So good morning. And okay, so like Michael said, I'm Hamilton. AKA Hammett. I founded the Castle project back in 2004. Before that, I used to be a committer for Apache back in my Java days. I don't have good memories of that. But it was the first opportunity to be introduced to this IOC word, and before it was the mainstream. This is the tentative agenda for today. We expect this to be a very collaborative kind of talk. You guys are welcome to participate, and I hope you will participate, because my goal here is to challenge your definition of IOC containers and DI. What do you think encourages good design or what not? And you're welcome to disagree with me, and I actually don't want to convince you. I just want you to think about it, step back, think about it, and how that affects your daily life when you're working. So principles, IOC container history, the infamous DI, in my opinion, demos galore, and anti-patterns. This is not a plug. It's from someone who works for Microsoft now. He's called Clemens Cypersky, and he used to work close to, well, I think actually he founded kind of the MEF project back in, I don't know, 2005. And he has a very authoritative book on componentized software, and I strongly suggest you to, if you love this space, to get this book. It's the definitive kind of book on this space. So are we on the same page? Let's make sure. So we have principles and pattern. Which definition do you think applies to principle? Which definition do you think applies to pattern? Okay, principle, which one is this? Regular form or basic assumption? I can hear you. Basic assumption. And pattern? Awesome. Okay, so we are on the same page. You guys are right. So then we have inversion of control. Inversion of control is a pattern or a principle? It's a principle. It guides you in a higher level than a pattern does. So inversion of control is what the name says. It's changing who is in control of execution code. So normally, you are writing imperative code that is using some library, some API, and then you are in the control. When you're using a framework, the framework is actually invoking your code, and then the framework is in control. Whenever the framework is in control, you have inversion of control. And then we have the famous Hollywood principle, don't call us, to call you, analogy, and that's helpful.
Actually, can I add something there really
sure.
quick? A really good example of the framework idea of an inversion of control would be ASP.NET web forms. As a developer, you go write a page. That page has some code and an object behind it, a class that can get instantiated. And that class is newed up by the framework when a request comes in. You don't actually new up your page. The framework does it for you. Good example of inversion of control.
Awesome. So when we take the principle of IOC and bring it forward to containers, what does it mean? Well, basically it means that you're surrendering control over your types, and you're giving them to a container, which is like a boundary, and this container takes control over some aspects of the types. Basically, the composition will be the first and foremost thing that it takes control over. So it takes control over the composition of how one type depends on the others. Types is one, it's the most famous aspect of composition containers, but it doesn't need to be necessarily this. But if we go down in this road, it's going to be an academic talk that is going to bore you to death. So lifetime is also another aspect. Ownership of those types, especially when they implement iDisposable, becomes another one. And there are a few more. But stepping back, what's the underlying goal? Isolation. So if you're using IOC container, DI container, your goal should be isolation. And why isolation is important? Because we don't want tight coupled design, right? We don't like that, right? Okay, I hope you're on the same page with me. We also like separation of concerns. What is separation of concerns? Your class, your service has one focus, one goal, and it does that and only that. If it needs to use more services to achieve its goal, it's fine. Then, hence the composition, like one aggregates more service to achieve a major goal. And then finally, the holy grail, reuse. If you have reuse, if you achieve reuse, you have types that you can bring together, match them together, and can create applications by just wiring types in a different way and adding some more policies. And that, it's faster time to market. Note here that I'm not talking about testability, because testability will be a side effect of isolation. Let's go through the history of C containers for those of you who don't know about it. So, 1998, I don't even remember what I was doing in 1998, but there was Apache. Apache was a major HTTP open source server, but they started a Java also side of the Apache Foundation. So JServe was one of the first Apache Java projects, and it was supposed to be an HTTP server, and later became Tomcat. But this was not the only server that they provided. So they wanted to also have an email server that became, I forgot the name, IMAP server, I forgot the name too, my memory doesn't help me today. And they noticed that they could reuse a lot of work if they managed to create some kind of foundation that they can reuse components across these projects. So they define interfaces that communicate dependencies or behavior. So if your class wanted to have a logger, it would implement an interface called iLogEnable, something like that. If your service want to have access to another service, it would implement an interface called iServiceEnable. And then it would get the service manager, and you can ask the service manager for more components. So it was IOC container, but in a very rudimentary way. And later, this set of APIs, set of interface, became the Avalon project. This whole thing was started by Stefano Mazzocchi, who created also the Cocoon projects. And today, I don't know if he still is, but he used to be the president or one of the board members for Apache. I don't know how many of you were Java developers back in 2002 or 2001 when you had this mainstream J2EE standards coming out. And you have the heavyweight containers, and then you have to create implementations with interface for remote and local, and you have all these XML descriptors, and you have all these nightmares that you have to manage sessionless and session full, and what's AGB managed persistence. And this was life for Java developers back in 2002, and Rod Johnson said, no, this, we can do better than this. And he published a book, which the title I can't remember, and just true. And the book basically described how you could create a better framework, which basically became the Spring Framework. And the Spring Framework idea was to be a lightweight framework with lots of integration with other frameworks, and wouldn't need the container, wouldn't need anything like this, and would use the Java Beans convention for properties. Like Java, you know that Java doesn't have properties like standard, but you have sets and gets as conventions, and that's a property in their world. And you also have, what's the name? Besides the properties, you also, the Java Beans convention defines conversions. There was a good things about the Spring Frameworks. One bad thing was that it used only properties. So, I mean, in 2002. So it was hard for your component to know when it was safe to use the services that it depends. So it was hard for, like, if you have a component that has four dependencies, it was hard for you to determine when it's safe to use those. So they introduced an interface. The interface would be a callback, so the framework would call that method, and then it was safe for you to use the service, which is kind of counterintuitive, but it worked. Then 2002, 2003, this was also members of the Apache Avalon team created Pico Container. And Pico Container was supposed to be the revolution. In what sense? They decided to use constructors and properties. So constructors is a good idea because it's an OOP idiom. It basically states that I need these things in order to work, in order to function. And Rod Johnson abided that, and then Pico, and then Spring Framework decided to also use support constructors. And then here comes Fowler. So Fowler was not involved in this space, and then he decided to do something to benefit of the whole community. He decided to rename the whole thing to dependency injection pattern. And Stefan Mazzocchi, back at that time, said, published a blog entry saying that DI misses the point, which I totally agree. So I can refer you to the blog post. Just a quote from the blog post. Take your time to read it. So the point here is that what IOC containers are doing is not injecting dependencies. They are encouraging isolation. And the dependency injection aspect of it is just a side effect or one way to accomplish this goal. It could be other ways, like back in the Avalon days, we used interface. It was not a nice approach. We had several drawbacks, but it was also another approach.
Actually, let's jump back there. And this is where one of the spots where we agree to disagree. Personally, Hammett's a lot more of a purist. I'm a lot more of a pragmatist. And if people, there's a whole bunch of object-oriented design principles and things that you should do if you're using an object-oriented language. And a lot of people don't do them. Either they think they're too hard, they don't think they have time for it, which sort of goes back to Uncle Bob's talk earlier today. But if somebody's able to take a subset of those things that you should do, put it into a nice, easy-to-understand package, and encourage people to do it, I don't see an issue with calling it dependency injection or calling it FRED. the name in my mind doesn't matter as much as the ideas behind it and the behaviors that are encouraged in developers writing good, clean, highly cohesive, loosely coupled code.
I abide to that. I disagree with the thing that the power is in you. Like, as I'm going further, you'll notice what I'm trying to make. So, what is a design pattern in the first place? So, it has a motivation. So, it's a recurring problem in this space, and it's a template for solving this problem. And it's easily identifiable. So, singleton momentum, you look at that, you know what's pattern you're using. So, can I say that a constructor parameter is a pattern, or a property, or fields, or methods, or introducing a variable in your method implementation, using for each, implementing IR numerable, are these patterns? Let's see an implementation of class. You can probably point a few good things about this class and a few bad things. Let's go with the good things first. What's good about this implementation?
Anybody. You see any good things on the screen here?
Sorry? Oh, gosh. Can you guys move forward? Sorry. Lots of private, that's good. The naming, it's quite clear. Customer notification sender.
If you, it's constructed, it goes.
I'm sorry?
Once it's constructed, it has the bits and pieces it needs, so you can use it.
That is true, if you can say that. Yeah, there is some controversy in this statement. What else? Like from the isolation, separation of concerns, and reuse, if you look at from this perspective, how would you rate this class? Like, is it isolated?
No.
But what about separation of concerns? It is separated? Yes, it is. Because the name of the class is Customer Notification Sender, and it only does one thing, send notification. The way that it's tied to implementation of these dependencies is a bad thing, but it doesn't damage this separation of concern aspect of the class. What about reuse? Is it easy to reuse this class? Why not? Because it's like a spaghetti, right? A poorly made spaghetti when you try to pull one and everything comes with it. So if you try to reuse only this class that defines a policy to send notifications, you have to bring together SMTP sender and velocity engine, template engine, directly template repository, and you also need to remember to put the folder configuration in the configuration file, otherwise it's going to fail in runtime. So, yeah, needs to be improved. So if you look to Uncle Bob's definition of bad design, do you think those applies to the code that we just saw? So it's hard to change because every change affects too many other parts of the system. Is it hard to change? Not particularly, like, because you have separation of concerns. So unless we are talking about one of the dependencies. So imagine that this implementation has a dependency on how any velocity template engine works. So that will be bad. When you make a change, you expect parts of the system break, fragility. So is this fragile? Not really, but depends on how it depends on dependencies. Oh, that's an interesting sentence. Then it could get ugly. And it's hard to reuse, that's for sure. If you look back to it, it's very hard to reuse.
For example, if you wanted to send customer notifications out via SMS as opposed to email, you'd have some issues here if you wanted to try to reuse this.
You have to change code.
You have to hack some code.
So then we have, just to add to the confusion of principles and names, we have the dependency inversion principle, which some people think it's connected to DI and IOC containers, and it's actually it isn't. So you can ask Uncle Bob. So it has different granularity of where you can apply this DI principle. So it could be modules, it could be types, it could be methods implementation, it could be the whole architecture of a system, like CLR. So I'm working on the CLR team, and we have outgoing work of this Tango, the framework. You probably don't notice that because you use the framework, and I don't think you will be impacted by some of the nasty things that happen in the framework over the years. Like, we have ASP.NET, and ASP.NET has a dependency on WinForms. Does it make sense? It doesn't, right? So these are things that we are trying to fix. And then we go back to dependency inversion principle. High-level modules should not depend upon low-level modules. They should depend on abstractions. And then we can look at the bad code again and say, okay, how we can apply dependency inversion here.
So can anybody think of a change that you would make to this class? Yes, sir. Pass the template into the constructor.
Actually, no. We're trying to fix first dependency inversion. So I have a high-level module here that is called Customer Notification Sender, and it should not depend on in concrete implementations of low-level modules. So it should depend on abstractions. Yes. Exactly. So how we would do that? Interface or?
Interface.
You were going to say something?
I was wanting you to repeat what he said because.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he said interface or abstract classes.
Interface.
Yeah, well, the debate about interface or abstract classes is an ongoing one. Let's not get into that. But yeah, interface or abstract classes would be fine. So if we change this.
So I think what you said was you want the constructor to receive an interface to a template engine.
No.
No. Okay, good.
So there are two steps. There are two steps to fix this class, right?
Okay.
So first we are applying dependency inversion principle. So high level module should not depend upon low level modules, as it is. So high level module is customer notification sender, right? If we make this as a stake in the ground. It's a high-level module that just takes care of a policy of sending notifications. It's a very small algorithm, right? So it depends on low-level modules like SMTP sender and velocity template engine. And what dependency inversion principle tells us is that instead of doing that, we need to depend upon abstractions. To fix this, we're going to introduce interfaces and or abstract types. So instead of having SMTP sender here, we're going to introduce an I sender or something that doesn't convey that it's actually send an email. It might send anything. It might send a smoke signal, but it's an abstraction of sending something. Same thing for template engine. Same thing for the template repository. And then we also should get rid of this.
So you would first change the internal fields there, or the private fields that are internal to the class, to be an abstraction as opposed to the a member variable holding the concrete implementation.
And are you talking about a two-step process because you're describing operationally how one should go about doing this?
No, I'm just trying to challenge you how would you approach this kind of problems and how some principles apply. So here we're only talking about, at this point in time, we're talking about dependency inversion principle and not about IAC containers or DI containers at all. So one is orthogonal to the other. That's my point. Moving. Another thing that you could do here to fix this class is use pure OOP idiom. Instead of creating things directly on the constructor implementation, you could use idioms such as properties or constructors to expose to the world what this class needs in order to function properly. And then we might be getting to the field of IOC containers or not. But so far, we aren't. So yeah, just use OOP. Communicate that through OOP. If I'm a user of your class, I go to VS, hopefully, and use new custom notification sender. And then the IntelliSense tells me, oh, it needs a template engine. It needs an email, or it needs a sender of something. It needs a template repository. So clear your communication giving, by just using OOP. And that's the point I was trying to make on how, when we get to that. So this is a fixed class, or a potential fixed class. So now it depends on abstractions. It's not taking dependence on SMTP senders, not taking dependence on any velocity implementation of a template engine. And it's also using OOP to communicate the dependencies through the constructor. That's all we have done so far. Then we can argue, okay, what you've done so far has nothing to do with IOC containers, DR containers. It was your refactoring towards a better OOP design. And then if you have a system that you apply this consistently, you're going to have several components that are isolated, that are that apply consistently separation of concerns, that are reusable, and by consequence, they are easily testable, and they are not using IOC containers or DR containers at all. It's just your good judgment in applying OOP idioms and refactoring properly.
And once you have a system or software that is following these principles for inversion of control, keeping things clean, keeping working through abstractions as opposed to concrete implementations, adding an IOC container to take care of a lot of the heavy lifting and getting those different external dependencies that are communicated as abstractions injected or brought into an object gets a lot simpler.
Yeah, which is my next point. Like, when you start doing this consistently in your application, you have good components as a derivative of the project, of the process. But the problem then becomes it's a manual task of wiring them together. And even though you can do that manually, wiring them together yourself, it becomes a nonsense job. Like, a machine could do that better. And then you could use a container. But the point is, DI is not doing anything for you. You are doing for yourself. You are using OOP properly, and then you have the benefits of using IOC container by side effects and having a reusable, isolated SOC-applied system.
Any questions so far?
Go ahead.
Yes. Your first version got a concrete template and sent it to an email sender.
Mm-hmm.
Your second version could easily be fed a template system that would deliver a huge graphic thing and then attempt to send it through an SMS.
Mm-hmm.
Because whoever is calling it.
Yeah. Yes.
So I'm not convinced that, for instance, this is more testable because the outcome of this code is less predictable.
Actually, then I would argue that if you want that, if you want like these capabilities, they should be explicit in the contract.
So the concern that was raised was, if, for example, somebody was had a template service that they were using that would create a large graphic, and the sender implementation was an SMS sender, so try to send through the SMS network, which doesn't handle anything other than very short text messages, you'd probably have an issue. And this does not constrain you from doing that sort of thing through the interface.
That is true. Like I said, then I would argue that you have to design your contracts better, the contracts being the interface, that communicate these capabilities or the capabilities that you need, the minimum capabilities that you need, so they can work together. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. More questions? Okay.
Okay. So at this point, adding an IOC container to help do the heavy lifting for to provide concrete implementations of these different interfaces would be fairly easy to do. And we're going to sort of look at the world's simplest container here, which is basically just a dictionary of types and funcs. So you can register types with a way to go create a concrete implementation of that, and you can resolve types. And if we wanted to use this, we could create a new container, register a couple of different services on it, register a way to go create a more complex object that requires those other services, and then somewhere else in our code, we could resolve this foo object that requires both implementations of IBAR and IBAS. And we don't have, when we're consuming the foo object, we don't need to worry about how those dependencies get satisfied. We just know that somewhere in the system, those dependencies are registered and we can use them. Now, this is fairly simple. It doesn't do a lot of other things that you probably want in a real IOC container, like some things which Hammett had mentioned before, like lifetime management. If I ask the container for a foo, do I get a new one each time I ask, or do I get the same actual instance every time? Do I get a singleton, or do I get new instance every time? There's other things that you might want to have, like configuration, ways to hook things up automatically. And there's a lot of containers out there that offer these other features. In alphabetical order here, AutoFat, Castle Windsor, Meph, which I'll say something about here in a second, Ninject, Spring.NET, StructureMap, Unity, and there's more and more of these IOC containers available. Meph is in this list, and this is a point of contention between Hammett and I, where Meph is actually the managed extensibility framework. It is for making applications that are easily extensible, where you can drop in a new piece of functionality and have it automatically light up. As a side effect and an internal implementation detail, it uses IOC, or I'm going to use DI as the term, even though you disagree with that term. And if you structure your code and only have simple needs for an IOC container, Meph can act as an IOC container. But it wasn't designed or built to be one. Anything to add?
Maybe things will change in the future.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah.
I cannot promise.
So we're actually going to go jump into Visual Studio here, but first I want to give you an overview of what we're going to do, overview of the two containers we're going to use. First, there's Meph, which is part of the .NET framework in .NET 4. It's, like I said, specialized and focused on extensibility. The other container I'm going to show is Unity, which Chris Tavares is going to wrote a few years back, and we use a lot of the deliverables that PMP produces, like Enterprise Library, Web Guidance, Prism, and it's more of a generalized IOC container, not specialized in one area or another.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
Like one thing that I also want to point out in this slide is that as Meph is lower in the stack compared to Unity or any other container, things get harder to do in this. Like, imagine the stack is CLR, which is JIT, garbage collector, and the engine, and then you have BCL, and then you have Meph. And then up there you have Unity. So Unity can take a dependence on several things. Meph cannot. So people keep asking for things like, oh, when you guys are going to support interceptors. And we cannot. Like, we can offer potentially the extension point so you can achieve interception or AOP capabilities. But adding that to the framework, it's hard.
So we're going to flip over to Visual Studio now. And we're actually going to start with a fairly well-written application that is a slot machine. And I actually borrowed this code from Chris from a talk he had done previously. And this slot machine, I'll run it before as we start up here. Very simple interface. Neither Chris or I are designers, and creating GUIs, you don't want to see the results. So we're doing a simple console application here. I can hit M to add some money to the machine. Do that a few times. I can spin. Oh, I didn't win. Spin again. Didn't win. And I can quit. Pretty simple code. Pretty simple application. And if we look at our program class here, which includes main, all we do is we create a slot machine, and we call this play method on it. Yeah, let me... Yeah, tools. That better? Or do you need bigger?
Hold down the control key and mouse out.
Woo. There we go. So we create a slot machine that has a couple of external dependencies. We call this play method, which is over in a partial class file here. And it... It is fairly simple. It just handles input and calls the appropriate methods on our slot machine. So when you hit the M key, it'll add money. When you hit S, it'll spin. When you hit Q, it'll quit. Otherwise, it'll show an error message. So if we go back over to our program, actually, I'll go over to our slot machine implementation here. And so if we go back to the discussion earlier with the other example with the customer notifier, there's a couple of the same sorts of problems we see here. We've got a high-level component, depending on low-level concrete implementations as opposed to abstractions of those low-level components. How can we fix that? Interfaces. Rather than having an depending on a console display here, I could depend on an iMachine display, which we haven't implemented yet. Instead of a spinner or a simple spinner, we could have an iSpinner, and instead of an airport winnings calculator, an iWinnings calculator. And if we change this really quick to do that, and then go extract these interfaces from the concrete implementations, or I'm going to cheat since I already have them created here. Oh, we're starting to run into a couple of issues in the code. We cannot convert things, because our concrete implementations don't know about the interfaces yet. Okay. And if we go to our console display and make it implement the iMachine display, and our simple spinner now implements iSpinner. And we're going to have one more issue here where there's an internal dependency. So it's a little bit of grunt work here to actually get this up and running. But we are now able to run. We get the same exact behavior we did before. And things are a little bit cleaner here. We haven't arrived at completely clean and well separated, but we're moving in the right direction. And now I could easily go to our program, and if I wanted to change how things got displayed, I could change this instead of using a console display. I could use a WPF display of some sort, or make other changes like that. Now, if I run the program again, there is one thing that, as a user, I would not like. And that's when I spin the slot machine, I can't see any of the results. I just get a message that says, sorry, you lost. Ideally, I'd be able to see, 5, 7, 3. No, I know I lost. Or 7, 7, 7, hey, I won the jackpot, right? So let's go add a new spinner that will actually show a bit of this. And I'm actually going to jump ahead here. Oops. And maybe not. Oh. Just a second. So, added a new implementation of iSpinner that's a display spinner. And it takes a dependency on a machine display. And all it does is pretty much the same thing that the other spinner does, except it also uses the display to spit out the results. And if I go over to our code, or go over and run the program, add some money, I spin, I can now see 4, 2, and 1 were the results of the spin. So I'm sure that I actually lost and I wasn't getting tricked by the machine. And if we go over to our program again, there's a bit of a challenge that came into play adding this in our management of all these of dependencies here. Because our display spinner needed an iMachine display to be passed into it, we had to create one up before we could create the spinner and pass that in to our slot machine. And this is a fairly simple object graph. And in a larger application, you can imagine how the dependencies and managing what got newed up when so it could be passed into the right constructors could get a bit ugly. So we're going to now bring in this case, Unity, to handle that for us. And based on our time, I'm again going to try. To bring this in. Okay, so a moment ago we were actually just newing up a slot machine, passing in the dependencies. Now we create an iUnity container, and we then call resolve on our slot machine, and then everything else is pretty much the same. And our container configuration is abstracted away into this getConfigured container method, and this is probably not where I would stop the refactoring, but it's good enough for demo purposes. You could easily go have the container created and get its configuration out of config file, or you could create a Unity extension that would encapsulate the configuration for this application, or move this over to another class where it might belong or have a cleaner separation concerns if it was elsewhere. For the demo, I think it shows things well enough here. And the big difference, all we really did was we added a reference to Microsoft Practices Unity and then changed how we got our new instance of a slot machine. Fairly simple. Any questions at this point? Yes, sir. Yeah, we could. The question was, over in the spinner class, rather than depending upon the actual display, would it not be better to use an eventing model? That could work. Different choice in this case to help show a simple concept. But yeah, in a more real-world situation, you might want to use an eventing model instead. Could work either way. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Do you get to a point to where you have to start passing the container around all the different types to resolve things that like maybe nested or deeper down in the graph?
So do you ever get to the point where you have to pass the container around because things that are deeper in the graph need knowledge of the container to create their dependencies or other things that they rely on? It can happen. Try to avoid it if possible. But we run into this in Prism, where the Prism uses IOC, goes through the Common Service Locator interface for a lot of the internal machinations of how it gets objects out of a container. That way, developers can plug in their own container instead of using either Unity or MEF. But there's a few spots that interface doesn't quite cover everything. You can't actually register things through this Common Service Locator interface. So in those cases, the container will be injected, used to do registration, and hopefully not used any further than that. There are other times that things get a little bit more interesting as well. Who here was in David Platt's talk yesterday on Prism? A few of you guys. He covered one of those cases where an object is created before all of its dependencies were registered with the container because of a bootstrapping process. And in cases like that, if you have to, you can do it. But it's preferred not to pass the container around if you can avoid it at all. Other questions? Okay. So at this point, things are fairly clear. But there is a little bit of a problem, and I'm going to put in a breakpoint on our display spinner constructor here. And the problem I'm going to show is that we're getting a new instance of the spinner, of the console display. That's what I want to show. We're getting a new instance of the console display when we probably shouldn't be. Set a breakpoint on the constructor. I hit F5. We hit the constructor. I hit F5 to continue. I must have bumped it twice. But basically what's going on is in our Let's try this one more. So hit it once, hit F5, we're back in it again. And the call stacks are a little bit different. Basically, what's going on is when we new up our slot machine, it's getting the three different dependencies injected into it. One of those is the machine display, or console display. The other one's a spinner, which relies upon a console display. And then there's a winnings calculator. So it's actually our container is newing up a new instance for each of those dependencies. And this is a lifetime management issue, which by default with Unity, everything is a transient object. It's not kept around. However, we can stop debugging and add a new container control lifetime manager, which basically says, I want Unity, every time I ask for an iMachine display, to give me the same instance and treat it as a singleton. So the first time you request one, it'll get newed up. After that, it'll just return that same instance. And if we run again, we're in the constructor, hit a 5, we continue on, we're not in there anymore. Fairly simple. However, you can do all sorts of neat tricks with lifetime management depending on the environment you're in and what you need to do. Unity has a number of lifetime managers. The transient, which is the default. There's the container controlled. There's a per thread. There's a per session. That sort of thing, depending on which context you're working in. So in ASP.NET, you could use a per session and have different objects around for an entire user session. And use the same instance for that one user and a different instance for a different user. And there's other container tricks like that you can use. Any questions about simple lifetime management before we move on?
5 minutes.
Hmm?
5 minutes.
5 minutes left? Ooh, in that case, we better hurry. So, if you remember back a few minutes ago, at one point we had just added the interfaces to our application. And our program just knew things up directly, right? I'm actually going to go show you the meth implementation really quickly since we don't have much time.
Or we can skip that. Like, you just add some attributes and
yeah.
It works.
Yeah. you have to add a number of attributes. They're a bit invasive, and it's a completely different style of development. With Unity, it's a very imperative, here, run this code to go register these things. If I want an object, I say container.resolve, which will give me an object. With meth, it's a lot more declarative. And on the types that you want to expose, you put an export attribute. Anytime you want to get a type injected, you put an import attribute or an importing constructor. And can basically get the same end result through different styles and different mechanisms. The code is going to be available to everybody. It's all in a Mercurial repository, so you can look at the different steps in the process for both the Unity and the meth implementations if you'd like. And those will be on the USB keys you guys get at the end of the week. There are a few things that I want to make sure we cover before we wrap up the talk. Basically, some guidance, some things you shouldn't do, some things you should. So definitely, as you're writing your code, try to use a solid OOP approach. Get things clean, depending upon abstractions instead of concrete implementations. And if you want, use a DI container to help with the heavy lifting of getting all those things wired up together. Avoid where you treat state as a service. In the first couple of lines of code here, we're resolving a customer object. This is probably not what you want to do in a real application. You want to resolve a service that will give you your entities, a repository service in this case, and then use that service to get whatever data entity that you need. It's a little bit of a fine distinction between the two, but in the end, you'll be a lot happier and have less issues if you go with the second route. Going back to the earlier question, avoid referencing the container if you can. There are some instances where you can't do so and can't get by without having it injected, but try to avoid those if at all possible. Stick to simple lifetimes if you can. Per thread, per web request, etc., can get a little bit interesting and hard to debug if there's issues. So going with a simple shared, non-shared, or transient and singleton, depending on which way you look at it. Oh, one thing to note on the different lifetimes, Unity defaults to a transient resolution. So every time you ask for an object, you get a new instance. Meth defaults to a shared lifetime where you ask for IFU, you get the same IFU everywhere in your app. So if you see differences in behavior between the two, that's probably a starting point to look at. Excessive dependencies, if you have a method that takes 8, 10, 12 external dependencies, you're probably doing a bit too much in that class, and there's another class begging to be factored out, or refactored out of the object you're looking at. My rule of thumb is I start worrying at about 4. Other people have different rules of thumb, but you prefer less over more. And if you guys want to go look at either Unity or MEF, there's a couple of websites to look at. Do you guys have any more questions before we're dragged off the stage by Don?
Go ahead. What do you mean by the first one? Push then? Like actively? But what's the contrast that you're making?
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that sort of thing instead, or container.resolve, the console display instead?
Yes.
So personally, I would opt for the approach where you're passing things in, if at all possible. In some situations like views, when you're doing WPF or Silverlight development and you're creating your user controls, if you want the designer to work, you have to have a default constructor that takes care of everything for you. And in those situations, I might actually have two constructors. One, the default, that does just what the designer needs. The other, which can be marked as the constructor used by your container. And there's in MEF, there's an injection constructor or importing constructor attribute you can add. In Unity, it just defaults to the longest constructor, so the one with the most arguments. And it's sort of a poor man's DI. If you didn't have a container, you could even do something like... that. So one constructor just calls the other with some sane defaults that work in the context you need. But even this can get a little bit iffy depending on how many dependencies there are. And it does tie you to some concrete implementations, which you might not want.
I can add something. Sometimes you have to use IOC.resolve as a static because you're dealing with a framework that is not built to be used with IOC containers, like web forms.
Yeah.
Can I say? We are on record. Oh, my God. So MVC was built to be used with IOC containers. Web forms isn't. So you have this mismatch.
And you can make web forms work with an IOC container. We've done it with the Web Client Software Factory and some of the web guidance since then. But it's not easy. And there are definitely challenges involved when the frameworks you're trying to use don't natively have a way to influence how things get newed up. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
The merge web request,
what's the manager? Chris, are you in here?
Yeah.
The per web request lifetime manager, that shipped with Unity 2, right?
It did not.
It did not. But you did have a per...
We added per thread, and we added per resolve.
Per thread and per resolve.
We were unable to figure out the required dependency management or reference management at the time that we had.
We didn't want to include a reference to... Oh, thank you. We didn't want to include a reference to the web assemblies in the main Unity assembly, and we didn't want to add another assembly to the pile, so that's why we didn't ship it in two. It's a very common request, and it's definitely on the list to get out there someday. I know the code has been published in multiple places. It just hasn't made it into the box yet.
Any other questions before we wrap up? Okay. In that case, enjoy the rest of the conference, and hopefully you guys got something out of this talk. Thank you.
Thank you.